Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
The thing is, we all know by now, right, that climate change is the biggest issue facing us. We all know on some level we should be radically changing how we live our lives, but most of us, we're not doing it or we're not doing enough. So Pete Lunn is head of the ESRI's Behavioural Research Unit and he joins me now. Good afternoon, Pete. Thanks for coming
in. Good afternoon, Brandon.
And Pete, I'm hoping you can explain what's going on here. So, like, on the most basic level, people's intentions are good, but it's just too hard to do what they need to do, is it?
Yeah, that's probably a fair way of putting it. So we know from the evidence that the very large majority of Irish citizens believe in human-caused climate change. And not only do they believe in it, but they're worried about it. And some of them are really worried about it. So most people will say they're either worried or very worried in answer to a simple survey question.
So the message has got through.
Totally, yeah. And we're very lucky in Ireland, actually, in many ways, because we don't have such political polarisation. At least it's probably because we don't, compared to some other countries. We have very few climate deniers. I mean, you're talking like a percent or something. I mean, almost everyone accepts human-caused climate change and is worried about it. So much so that when we ask people just to list in an open question the issues that worried them the most, health and housing both came up very high, but the next one on the list was climate. So it really has registered in the public consciousness, yes, and people are genuinely worried about it.
Explain to me about status quo bias and present bias. I like this.
Well, present bias is the easy one. That's the one that means that we tend to prioritise now over the future. We find it really hard to give as much weight to outcomes in the future as we do now. And, you know, I think we all know that we're fundamentally a bit impulsive, even if some of us are more so than others. So that's a straightforward one. Status quo bias is a little bit different. It's a fascinating phenomenon, actually. I mean, it sounds like a kind of piece of fancy academic language to say that people don't like change. And there's a bit of truth in that, but it's more subtle than that. It's like this. If you say to somebody, we're going to change the way your town is laid out, you know, we're going to make it more friendly for pedestrians and cyclists, let's say, and you say there's a plan to do that, a lot of people instinctively resist that. You know, actually, these policies are typically fairly popular, but there's a substantial minority that will really quite strongly resist it. If instead of telling them it's a plan, you say, oh, there is a town that has this layout. Do you like it or not? You get completely different responses. So it's as if when something is a plan for change, we instinctively, psychologically react to it more negatively. Now, I think anyone who's ever tried to seriously reform an organization or a system has had their own battles with status quo bias. When it's a proposal, when it's a plan, it's as if human beings have a kind of inbuilt resistance. It's like a kind of defense against the law of unintended consequences or something. If someone else is planning or proposing something, we look for the negatives in it.
Okay, whereas if you can give somebody an example of something and say, look at this here, how this works, they're a bit more open to it.
They will evaluate it very differently. They'll look at the pros and cons in a more open way.
So now, you would say then we should be looking at where there are kind of models of good practice or communities that are doing good things, presumably, and show that to people in terms of climate change.
So we are actively researching at the moment with the National Transport Authority status quo bias. We're trying to say, what can we do to get people to look more even-handedly at the pros and cons of change?
Okay.
And we know some things already. So you're right, demonstration really does make a difference. You know, and that's even if you can read about something. So, I mean, I've been working and researching in this area and reading all about it. But a couple of weeks ago, I found myself in Utrecht, where the very large majority of the population cycle everywhere instead of driving. And it is absolutely remarkable when you actually see it with your own eyes.
100%
and
agree.
See what it can be like. You know, even, you know, I'm reading all these articles about it, I'm looking at all the numbers, but when you actually see it, you really do see what's possible. So familiarity with change and the demonstration of the benefits that that change can produce is really important. Now, that is not to say that all of these reforms and all of these changes are going to be good. I mean, on average, we actually know that most of them are perceived afterwards to be effective. And here I'm talking about the ones that are really changing transport and changing the pedestrianisation of towns and cities. People tend often to oppose them, not a majority, but a lot of people will oppose them. And then afterwards, they'll quietly say, well, actually, it's really improved the place. On average, that happens. But of course, there are some times where there are plans and proposals that have mistakes in them and things go wrong, and that can happen, of course.
Okay, so I think part of it then is, are we being honest with ourselves here about what is required? Do we actually, is what's required here like mass-scale systemic change of the kind that we've never really contemplated before, that has maybe happened over generations before?
Yeah, so I mean, I certainly think from my perspective as a researcher who's, you know, worked in evidence for policy for a long time, I've certainly never seen a policy area that appears to demand such scale and scope of change in such a short period of time, which as a behavioral scientist makes it really interesting. But one of the big blocks here, it's not just scale, I used the word scope there as well. One of the big problems is how many different aspects of our daily lives it potentially affects. Now, we've done studies where we've asked people whether they understand the actions in their daily lives, which ones of them have a high impact on emissions, which have a medium and which have a low. And we got people to categorize different actions. And generally speaking, we're really not very good at it. And that's because it's hard and it's complex and we're exposed to contradictory stuff in the newspapers and, you know, on the radio and in various places. You know, how good are electric cars for the environment? Oh, someone says they're not as good as we thought. All of this kind of contradictory information and the complexity of it and all of the different actions you could take. In any one day, you could take multiple actions that would lower your emissions or increase your emissions. People are paralyzed by that because of the complexity of it and because we lack that knowledge. And interestingly, our research actually suggests that younger people are no better than older people when it comes to actually having that knowledge about what causes emissions. Now, for me, what that means is it has to be system change. We can't rely on individuals because what you're asking them to do is too damn hard.
Okay.
So you've got to give them systems and incentives and help them to do what's going to lower emissions.
Okay. But it's not. It's going to come at a price. There's sacrifice involved in everything. Does that mean that really governments, as they are in democracies and everything, they're probably not best set up to do this because it would be kind of suicidal for any government to really hit people with what actually needs to happen?
Unfortunately, I think governments are the only thing that's set up to do this. So it's government or nothing, isn't it? And governments.
So maybe democracy is the problem then, is it?
Well, okay, but that gets really interesting, doesn't it? Because, you know, there are those different views of democracy about the degree to which, you know, democratically elected politicians should attempt to do what's popular in the name of the people, or whether they should attempt to influence what's popular. And what's interesting here is we have another collective action problem, just like we had in COVID. One of the things that's holding everyone back is that none of us want to be the mug that makes all these changes if we watch other people not do it. We need to feel we're all doing it together. And that means that government can genuinely coordinate that and can change incentive systems so that more people do behave in greener ways. And when we see each other behaving in greener ways, well, we'll feel more comfortable doing it ourselves. So can it be done? Maybe. Yes, maybe it can. But the only game in town his government to really lead it.
Okay, and it's interesting you bring up the pandemic because, look, we can say this now in retrospect, and I don't use propaganda, the word propaganda, in a negative way here, but I suppose you were kind of part of possibly the biggest, most successful propaganda operation that ever happened in this country, certainly, and it really worked well. So there's a need for something, for example, like that we're all in it together.
Yeah.
So simple, but as you say, got everybody kind of doing stuff. No one felt like
the world. Early understanding of the nature of that collective problem and how we communicated about it. I mean, I'm obviously not going to use the word propaganda. I mean, I think effective.
Well, it's such negative connotations. Well, but I mean, it was manipulation. I mean, like, you got people to behave in extraordinary ways without that much complaint.
Right.
And that's what needs to happen
If you're explaining to people why, if they act in a certain way and everyone else does the same thing, it will make us all better off, I think that's highly effective communication when you face a collective action problem. And do we need a load of that to help us with climate change? Yes, we do. But here's a crucial thing, Brennan. One of the things that makes climate change different is we're each being asked to behave somewhat differently, whereas in COVID, we were all being asked to do the same thing. The problem here is, depending on your walk of life, whether you're a farmer, whether you're an urbanite who works in an office, whether you live in a small town, whether you live near the coast where an offshore wind farm is proposed, whatever, the sacrifices you are being asked to make are different for different people. And that means you're kind of comparing what's being asked of me with what's being asked of others. And is it fair? And but the actions and the consequences are different. So the communication problem is actually much harder.
But we had an answer to that in COVID, didn't we? Which was pay off people in accordance with the sacrifice they were making. So publicans and restaurants got a lot more money than some other people. And is that a way
to do it? Yeah, so that's really good. So what people perceive as fair becomes incredibly important when you're being forced to compare apples and oranges. You're being forced to compare different effects on different people's livelihoods and lifestyles and say, okay, what's fair here? How much should people be compensated? What's crucial is you've got to research that really carefully because it's subtle. So people's perceptions of fairness as we go on this journey, you know, what they think is fine. I mean, good examples like, you know, what do we do about people who are flying 10, 15 times a year? You know, do we think they should be paying more for doing that to compensate us for the extra emissions they produce? Is that fair, or is it just an aspect to their family and their work that they have to travel this much. So what's the right amount of compensation?
Oh, man. You know, yeah.
These
okay.
are difficult issues,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And we have to research them and we have to do, we have to follow what people perceive to be fair and we have to explain them well enough so that people can see why it is that compensation is going in different directions and that people are being asked to change at different speeds and in different ways.
Okay. When do you think we might have a coherent plan of communication around this? I'm taking from what you're saying that the ESRI and you're actively working on this, presumably to feed into government in some way, yeah?
Yeah, we are, and we are already feeding into government. To be honest, we started, my unit, the Behavioural Research Unit, started working on climate shortly before COVID hit. And then, you know, 2-3 years, we got waylaid with that, and we're now back doing that. So a lot of the work that we do is on climate. It is on perceptions of fairness. It is on how to communicate in ways that will try to coordinate better collective action. But we really have only just started this journey, and let's face it, Brendan, it's going to be with us not just for a year or two, it's going to be with us for a decade or two or more.
Pete, you were always great at nudges during the pandemic. So any practical kind of nudgy ideas here for how we can talk about this ourselves, how we could bring different people on board, or how we might just change our attitudes or our lives a bit?
I think communication with each other about it is a really important thing. And it's hard, isn't it? I mean, here we are, yeah. lunchtime on a Saturday, talking about damn climate change. I'm not sure everyone would want to be hearing it, you know. But can we get it into the everyday conversation?
It's the most exciting, tricky issue that there is. Fascinating.
Right, okay. So if we can manage to talk about it on a daily basis, I do think it makes a huge difference. I mean, if you know that friends of yours are, for example, actually asking themselves, should I be driving less than 2 kilometres, or will I make an effort whenever it's, you know, less than a sort of 20 minute, half an hour walk to actually walk or to cycle? And you're actually saying, you know, I'm genuinely doing this because I think this is the right thing to do. If you heard other people doing it, you might become more inclined to do it. I can give you a good example of that, actually.
Yeah.
In my community of international researchers at the moment, a lot of them are now saying that they won't fly, that they'll only do conferences online or that they can get to by train, particularly the British academics who've got the option to get the train through to Europe. So
okay.
to go to European conferences, a lot of them will travel for 2 days by train and they'll only do it online and they won't fly. And because they're now saying that to each other, more of them are doing it because they feel, well, look, I can do this and I won't be the only idiot doing it.
There's so a kind this of collective stuff can be viral, started. Like almost contagious, like, yeah.
Exactly. But that's only going to happen if we communicate with each other about it.
Yeah. And I think, you could call it shaming too on another level, like, but that, you know, it, it
right,
is.
But it,
don't
but it doesn't have to be. It doesn't
other.
Have to be. It can just be encouragement. I mean, another really good one here is diet. I mean, I think increasingly I find, you know, that people are more willing to talk about the fact that they're changing their diets for reasons of climate. And when you see other people doing it and you see other people changing what they order and changing what they cook, it's bound to have an effect on all of us. You start saying, well, maybe I should be doing some of this too.
I think a lot of people don't think of diet as being an important part of their living an ecological life. Again, this is back to like people not realising which bits are important. Is diet a big part of this?
This is a really big problem, actually. When we tested it, we actually found that on average, the population thought using a reusable shopping bag did more for climate than eating a plant-based diet for a year. Now, that's obviously the wrong way round, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
eating a plant-based diet does make a huge difference. Now, I don't want to get preachy about this. I'm not a vegetarian. I eat some meat, although I do find myself reducing how much I'm eating. And when I come across more people who are reducing more, I think, well, maybe I should be doing the same thing.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly
the conversations that we should be having, because it's what actually, it's like the oil that runs a collective action problem is the communication that we have between us about what we're trying to achieve.
Okay, well, listen, I think you've done a very good job there at maybe nudging and prompting that conversation. And like, I absolutely think, Pete, this is not boring stuff for a Saturday afternoon. It really isn't. And I think you helped make it not boring. Maybe we can talk again in the course of as you go on looking into this and figuring it out and everything. So Pete Lund from the ESRI, thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Brendan.
Okay.